Well, I'm delighted to have you here. I've talked to a number of your compatriots, Penelope Lively and Faye Weldon and quite a few others whose names escape me, but over the course of many years I've interviewed a lot of your... Do you call them competitors?
Colleagues and friends. Competitors not, no.
You've been to the United States before, haven't you?
I have several times, yes.
But not on a book tour?
I've never done a book tour, no.
What's a book tour like?
Well, I've just done Canada. And I'm on my first day here, so I don't know what it's like here. But I enjoyed Canada.
What did you do there?
I started off at the Penn Congress in Toronto, and then I went across the country, ending up in Vancouver, and then I came over from Vancouver yesterday to New York. But I did readings and interviews, radio, print interviews, meet the public, that sort of thing, bit of everything.
That's a wonderful thing to be able to have the opportunity to talk about your work, isn't it?
Well, it's very nice talking about it when people... seem pleased to see you and pleased to hear you, and yes, it is. It's very good, and I find it very interesting talking to a lot of very different people in the same day who ask you totally different questions and jump from one thing to another. So you get I learn a lot about the country I'm in. Really, I mean, I dare say people learn about me, but I also learn an awful lot about what's going on.
Now, the natural curiosity. I understand this is the. Second of what will be a trilogy, is that correct?
That's my present intention, but as I'm only halfway through Volume 3, I'm still keeping my fingers crossed slightly about it.
Now, in the original, the name of the first book was what?
The Radiant Way.
The Radiant Way, that's correct.
The Radiant Way was Volume 1.
You are examining the lives of three women. You're carrying them through, I guess, over the generation. Tell me about these women, how these characters develop. And what they're doing in terms of, I guess in some respects, they say an awful lot about British society, British culture today, as well as the way people deal with each other in Britain. Tell me about these women.
Well, I wanted them to be reflections of different aspects of Britain. When I started the book, I conceived it as a book about the first half of the 1980s. And I wanted to have three points of view on that, but three not too different points of view, so they could have conversations with each other about it. So these three women represent a sort of middle class, but not mainstream middle class society. One of them is a child of refugees from refugees from Austria, so she's Jewish, so she represents a sort of slightly outside view. And one of them is from a very weird working class family in Yorkshire, and one is from a sort of more mainstream middle class, but left-wing middle class family. So they meet together at college, and one of them is a psychotherapist, so she represents the sort of psychoanalytical view of life. She's also apolitical, really. She doesn't care what Mrs. Thatcher's up to, so long as she's got her private income and her public income, and she's got both. The second is a kind of social worker, civil servant, teacher. She has a variety of part-time jobs, as so many women do. And she represents the serious, concerned, left-wing, progressive view. And the third is an art historian who represents art and the ivory tower and aesthetics, and who doesn't really care what's going on in the rest of the world at all. She's just interested in art. So I got three useful characters to look at Britain through. And then I tried to fill in the panorama. I tried to do London and the north of England, which are very, very different, and show how people can move between the two, how different life is in different parts of London. A sort of panoramic attempt.
While a natural curiosity stands on its own, I have this feeling that I wish I had read A Radiant Way before. I think it would have been helpful because there are some passing references and people that come kind of float in and float out that I have a feeling were developed to a greater detail in A Radiant Way.
I'm sure that's right. I'm sure it's easier to read if you've read the first one. I was worried that it wouldn't stand up on its own at all, and of course it's almost impossible for me to see that because I know it. I know both volumes so well that I can't tell where the break comes, and I think it is easier to read.
No, it does stand up.
Good. Well, I hope it does. I hope it does.
It's just that I have a natural curiosity to find out what happened before.
Right.
Tell me, that the title comes from what?
Well, the title comes from the natural curiosity that we all have about unpleasant things. And I suppose the title is in the form of a question, is our curiosity natural? One of the main lines of the plot is the pursuit of a murderer's origins by Alex Bowen, one of the characters. And she has a sort of morbid curiosity. And really it's a playoff between natural curiosity and morbid curiosity. I think that in these days we are obsessed by violence, murder, disaster, genocide, horrible things going on. The news is full of bad headlines. And our curiosity is being fed all the time by the media. And I suppose what I'm asking is it natural? Is mankind basically really interested in violence and horror? Or could we all have a nice time and a peaceful coexistence? Probably not.
Yeah, you're right. The violence is in the book, in A Natural Curiosity. It's there. The mass murderer of one of the characters is mugged as he jogs and so forth. And these are things that you think, from our side of the ocean, they don't happen in Britain.
We would like to think they don't happen in Britain, and some of us pretend they don't, but they do. And I think some of my British readers have been rather upset by this portrait of Britain as a country on the verge of various kinds of violence. But most people know that that is true, and it's happened very rapidly. 20 years ago, I had no fear at all walking around London, walking alone on the Heath, walking under a subway, going on the underground at night. Now, I do it, but I question myself while I'm doing it. And I suppose one of the big questions is, why does this violence accompany, in the US, a very successful, wealthy nation? Highly civilized, highly cultured, why is it that there's always this undertow of violence and fear? And is it, as some people believe, the increasing gap between the rich and the poor, which creates this friction on that interface between the two? And that could be the explanation, but I don't, in the novel, state that it is. I just suggest it.
No, I don't think the gulf between rich and poor causes. There are a variety of causes in this country. The chief cause, I think, is drugs. Terrible,
right.
Terrible drug addiction that has happened.
Well, we haven't got on to that yet in quite the big way that you have. There were one or two references to drugs in the novel, but it's quite obvious that it's a marginal issue. There's a moment where Alex wonders whether her murderer, when she goes to see him in prison, would really like her to slip him some heroin, but she doesn't know where to get hold of it and what's the point. But that there's a, but it's a very marginal sort of joke reference to drugs. We're very worried that what you get, we get. But, I mean, the question I would like, my natural curiosity about drugs is not sort of where do they come from or what do they cost, but why people are so desperate to have them in this rich and varied society where there's so much else to do. Why is it that that's what people want?
Everybody wonders that. Drugs cut across social and economic lines as well.
Yeah.
The New York Times, I believe today or yesterday, has been running a series of drug addiction, and I think, did you read the Times today?
I saw that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, why it is that people do these things to themselves when they've got everything else going for them. I mean, I can understand it if you're on welfare and have got absolutely nothing to do but watch television, then, you know, anything that gets you out of that is good. But if the rest of your life is fine, it's a mystery. And it seems to me that until they solve the demand problem, they'll never solve the supply problem.
There's also a vast social underclass that has lived in poverty that has not been able to get itself out for some reason. Nobody seems to know why, but no matter what sort of federal programs are developed, mm-hmm. what kind of educational opportunities are made available, it just doesn't seem to work for a great segment of people.
Well, this we do have in Britain too, to a less developed extent, but a lot of people now are very worried that society has turned into a sort of onion shape with a very few people on top and a very few people on the bottom and most people doing very nicely in the middle. But the people on that lower rung, that 10 or 20%, will never get up into the middle because there's nowhere, all the programs in the world don't seem to help them. Mm-hmm. And we don't have all those programs, frankly. We've cut back our spending on the underprivileged. So there are people on the streets and people begging, which is a sight that you never used to see in London.
Yeah. That's right, and you see it everywhere in New York. And there's another, well, there are a couple of other cultural factors, too. One, there's a great deal of mental instability that you see vividly that you didn't see 15, 20 years ago with these miracle drugs. People who were mentally ill were kept in institutions, but with the miracle drugs, they were released with the assumption that the miracle drugs would deal with their schizophrenia and calm them down and so forth. So they were turned out of the institutions, mentally ill people in given rooms. But the drugs really didn't help. So many of the homeless people that you can see in New York City are actually they're mentally ill people who should be institutionalized. I don't know if that's a phenomenon in Britain. There's another factor, too. I think that the United States is much more permissive in many respects than Britain is. For example, people just don't want to take orders in this country. They want everything. They don't like police officers. They want to carry guns.
Yeah.
And there is a greater demand for individual freedoms here that wouldn't be tolerated someplace else. And these individual freedoms are not necessarily positive. I mean, I want the freedom to carry a semi-automatic weapon. I mean, I don't consider that
yes.
a basic freedom.
No. Well, we are, on our side of the Atlantic, slightly puzzled and bewildered by all of that. And it is very interesting. I've just been in Vancouver, and they say that if you compare the murder rate in Vancouver and Seattle, very similar places, the murder rate in Seattle is that much higher, simply because people do it with guns instead of with knives. And I'm sure there are violent and disturbed people in Vancouver, but they don't actually kill one another, because they haven't got the weaponry to do it with. And we in Britain still think that it's wrong to let people play with guns.
A lot of us here think that,
yeah.
Well, let's talk about you and how this all began for you. Tell me where you grew up and what it was like as you were a little girl and your family.
I grew up in South Yorkshire, which is the sort of north of England that I describe in A Natural Curiosity. And it was, in those days, a very prosperous steel city, Sheffield, where I was born. Of course, the war intervened, so it was. I have memories of air raids and that kind of thing. And I went to school in Yorkshire. Eventually, everywhere recovered from the war, and it rebuilt, sometimes not too prettily. Then I went to university. My father was a barrister, became a judge. He later in life published two novels after he retired. Oh. My elder sister is a novelist. My mother was a teacher of English.
So you had a literary household.
We certainly did. We were encouraged to read books, partly because it kept us quiet and out of the way. My mother didn't like too much noise around, so reading books really, you know, that was virtuous. So having spent my childhood reading books, I grew up and thought I'd write some.
Do you recall the books you read as a girl that might have influenced you?
Well, I think the first adult novel that I thought was wonderful was Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. Mm-hmm. Wuthering Heights was the first book that really grabbed me. I think it was the same for a lot of people. Then Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte. So I think it was that sort of the romantic 19th century novel really turned me on. And then I just began to read omnivorously. I read everything and still do. I mean, I read a bit of everything.
When did you decide that you would like to write your own work?
Well, I think when I was very little, I wanted to be a writer. I thought it would be wonderful to be a poet. And I wrote really dreadful poetry when I was at school. And then I forgot about that because I decided I was more interested in other things. I wanted to be an actress when I was at university and married an actor and tried to be an actress for a year or two. But that was rather difficult. I had a baby and my husband was getting all the jobs, so I sat down and wrote a novel.
Did you study theatre in university?
No, I didn't, but I studied English. There wasn't a course in drama, but it was actually a very exciting period at Cambridge. All the people that I was with have made names for themselves. I mean, Peter Hall and Trevor Nunn and Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi and Eleanor Bron, some of our biggest names were acting then in the theatre. It was a very, very creative period, and it was the exciting place to be, which is why I was attracted to it.
Tell me about your first book.
My first book I wrote in Stratford-upon-Avon, where my husband was appearing with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and off he went every night to be on stage, and at home I sat bored out of my mind with nothing to do and no friends. And I wrote a novel, which I just started writing very casually, of an evening to keep myself company. And when I got towards the end of it, I didn't really think about publishing it at all, nor did I think it was a novel. It was a sort of very half-formed intention. And I'd written this pile of paper. I rang up a friend in London and I said, I've written this thing that I think is a novel. Tell me how long a novel should be. And she said, sort of 60 to 70,000 words. So I counted my pages and I thought, I've finished. And I slapped an ending on and I sent it off to a publisher. And to my astonishment, after 3 months, during which they obviously didn't look at it, they finally rang up and said they'd do it. So I'd suddenly become a writer. I was amazed.
That was sudden.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I was astonished.
Well, I've talked to so many writers of close to your caliber. Many of them start writing short stories, a little story, and they might have a little short story collection if they're lucky, sales of maybe 2,000, and a fledgling first novel of usually very slim. And it's hard, and they work their way up, but you just plunged right in somehow.
I plunged right in. I must say it was a slim novel, my first novel. But I was 21 when I wrote it. I think I was 23 when it was published. So I didn't really have any of those terrible problems that people have. But I have to say that I couldn't earn my living from it. If I remember rightly, the advance I had on this novel was £50. So you can see it took me quite a long time to earn my living as a writer.
Well, in this country, fledgling writers are always cautioned not to expect to make a living from their writing.
Mm, that's right, and that's absolutely correct. I still think £50 was a bit mean.
There's a wonderful story that Ambrose Bierce tells. He wrote an essay about the publisher, Henry Holt. Henry Holt had delivered a speech, a lecture, in which he advised young writers to have some other form of work so as to supplement their income as writers. And Ambrose Bierce thought about that. And he wondered, he said, I wonder if anybody had ever told the melancholy Mr. Holt if publishers should have some other form of work to supplement what they do.
Very, very well replied, yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, there are some successful commercial novelists in the United States, very successful, but the vast majority of writers, especially those who are critically hailed, must find other forms of income, including Saul Bellow, for example, teaches at the University of Chicago, and he won the Nobel Prize.
Perhaps he likes teaching, too.
He might like that.
That's quite a common pattern in England as well. I've always been very wary about it, because I think that academic life doesn't necessarily go with creative writing unless you've got a very strong personality. You get sucked into a more analytical view of life than I feel comfortable with. But I have earned my living, I suppose, with a variety of freelance activities, like doing radio programs, doing reviewing, writing articles, travel pieces, marking examination papers. I used to do one day's teaching a week in an adult education college, but that actually became a sort of charity on my part because they didn't pay very much either. But you can sort of get by with a mix of these things. And some of them are very stimulating to you as a novelist. I mean, if you just sit there being a novelist, you've got nothing to write about except the inside of your own study. So some of these things I've done have been positively useful, and I've enjoyed them very much.
Yeah, isn't that why Graham Greene went around the world looking for ideas?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm setting my next novel, in Southeast Asia, and as I was struggling to get my visa to the Thai-Cambodian border refugee camps, I thought, what on earth am I doing this for? And then I thought, well, it's partly for copy and partly because of Graham Greene. I mean, there you are, that you have this model of this great writer on a quest. And there comes a point in life when your children are grown up, as mine are, when you think, well, you can go. You too can go to those places, and you too can write about that sort of thing, and that's rather exciting.
Yes, it is. Tom Keneally has a new book set in Ethiopia. And he's another international class writer because It's incredible. He's an Australian, but he doesn't write Australian books, per se. His books are set in places all over the world. He wrote a very successful book called Confederates, which was about the United States Civil War, for example. And he came, and oddly enough, he lived in Connecticut while he wrote it. Mm. But there was enough proximity for him to do his research here.
He has this great historical sweep that he can do, which I must say I enormously admire. But I think this question about being an international novelist is a very interesting one, because I'm conscious that I'm a very British novelist, that most of my novels have been deeply rooted in British culture and their commentaries on British society. And I suppose I now feel, especially as I have been gadding around the world a bit over the last few years, that I want to break out of that. But one doesn't want to become just a sort of globetrotter or a jet aeroplane writer. You want to write about what you see and to feel it and see it. But I suppose there is a temptation now to try and respond to the larger subjects, which Keneally does so successfully. But I wouldn't have thought 20 years ago that I'd be interested. I mean, I'm surprised, really, by the direction some of my own interests are taking. And I think it is through having been invited to travel, through having taken myself to places, and you see the world as a different place.
And besides, you have a natural curiosity.
Indeed I do. That takes me to some dangerous and funny places sometimes, but yes, I do.
Talk to me a little bit about the craft of writing. You say we have a young would-be writer sitting here with us at this desk, and she or he wants to write his first story. And he says, Mr. Appel, I don't know how to begin it, but what would your advice be?
I find this almost impossible to answer, and for this reason I've never taught a creative writing class, because I don't know. I don't know how to do it myself, let alone tell anyone else how to do it. I think it's a mysterious process. I think what I would say is, if you're asking that question, go away and do something else. I mean, you've got to have within yourself the need to get something down on paper. What I do say to writers is, or would-be writers, is finish what you're doing. Don't just keep starting a short story or starting a novel. Don't just write the first few pages and then decide it's no good, because you learn an enormous amount by getting to the end, and then you see it as a whole, and you realise the length of it and the shape of it. And then perhaps it may be no good, but you'll do it better next time, simply through having persevered with the whole. I think one of the dangers of would-be writers is this idea that there's a short story or a novel in your head, and it's fine there, but you've got to try and get it down, even if it loses luster day by day as it gets down there. At the end, you'll have learnt.
When you sit down at your typewriter or word processor, do you have an idea pretty well in your mind about how you are going to proceed, or do you start with a blank page?
I hate starting with a blank page. I do sometimes when I'm in the middle of a book, because I haven't had time to think about where I'm at. But what I like to do is to have a lot of ideas, a lot of material before I sit down. So in a way, the writing is just the process of getting it onto the page. And the really hard work for me is getting it to that stage, which takes place while I'm going for walks or driving the car or cleaning the house or doing something physical, sitting at the desk with nothing in my head is my idea of a nightmare, and it does sometimes happen to me, and then I will say this is no good and I will take myself for a walk or go and dig the garden.
So what you're saying is that you are mentally writing, you try to mentally write, plan these things out so that when you sit down it can kind of gush onto the page.
That's correct. And so all the time I'm putting ideas together and occasionally making notes. And when I'm when I've done some really good work in my head and sit down, I can write very, very fast indeed. I mean, my family say it's terrifying to hear the sound of the typewriter, but that only happens in bursts when I've had a good thinking week, or perhaps when I've been frustrated over the weekend with sort of doing other things, and then you get down to it and it's good. But other times, you know, you can barely squeeze out a few sentences, and then you know it's time to go and dig the garden.
Bobby Ann Mason is well-regarded short story writer and novelist here, and she was sitting where you were sitting a few months back, and she was telling me that her normal approach to writing a story is just to capitalize on a phrase. She will actually sit with a blank sheet of paper, but she'll have a phrase in mind, And she'll write that first sentence, and then she'll think about another sentence, and then a character will develop. And it's a struggle for her, but it does seem that's a rather awkward way to do it, but that's the way she does it.
It sounds painful to me because of that sort of anxiety about where it's going to come from. But I know what she means, because sometimes when I'm in the middle of a novel, I will go there and I'm not quite sure what happens next, but you write a sentence, that a sort of linking sentence, and then you do see the next turning. It's a bit like driving a car. You don't know the route, but you know that this road looks more promising than the other, and you go along it, and then sometimes you see a wonderful little diversion, and you go along that, and there you find exactly what you were looking for, and that's wonderful.
Do you work with an editor?
Not very closely. I tend to finish the novel, then send it off, and then meekly accept all the criticisms and queries that come bouncing back again.
That's the point. The editor might say to you, this character needs to be developed, or this scene is not clear. Does this happen, and do you pick up on that?
Not very much at my stage. And indeed, my early novels, nobody questioned at all, because I don't think they knew about editing in those days, those prehistoric days. I think people have got much keener on editing over the years. But I did have in New York a wonderful editor, Bob Gottlieb, who was wonderfully acute in saying, now, why is this bit not developed? And he'd always put his finger on the bit that I really was worried about, so I'd go away and do a bit more work. So yes, you can get some very useful suggestions.
Was he working on a book that had been published previously in England?
No. I mean, he was, in fact, I can honestly say he was much better at that sort of thing than my English publishers were at that stage. He was very, very quick. Or maybe it was just that his mind and mine saw the same things and he quickly identified problems. There's one passage he made me take out of three novels back, The Middle Ground. I rather regret it, actually. I think I should have stood up for it and left it in. But he said a very damning thing, actually. He argued with me for some time over the telephone about why it should go. And then he finally said, you know, Maggie, this passage is rather vulgar. And that word went to my heart. I thought, no, it'll go. Fine, I gave in.
Writers don't have to give in, though.
Of course they don't, no. But he obviously cared very much about that. No, quite often I just don't listen. I defend myself. I mean, in this present novel, there's a lot of tense hopping, sort of from the past to the present tense. And this disturbs various people. But I stick by it. I think I know what I'm doing. And I think some readers like it, some readers don't, but that's what I'm doing, so it just has to stay where it is.
Now, you've published 10 novels now, is that right? Does it get easier or harder as it goes on? Technically, it's easier.
Well, I don't know if it does, because you're always trying to do something different. I mean, it's not like sort of repeating yourself. It actually does get harder. I think it gets harder. I suppose you expect more of yourself. You take on more difficult material. So, and you can never be sure it'll happen. You know, it's like it's not like riding a bike. You could just forget how to do it, and fall off, and it would never happen again. And there's always this slight feeling of fear that you've lost the knack, or sometimes I think perhaps I've even lost the interest. Perhaps I don't want to write another novel. So it's a very uncertain business. So there's never, ever been with me that feeling, I shall now sit down and begin a novel that in 2 years' time will be published. I've never had that confidence.
You say that sometimes you think you don't want to write another novel.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be because you've already done it? Why not do something else?
That's exactly what I have felt at certain points in my life, and I felt this really quite strongly in 1980 when I stopped writing fiction for 6 years. And I just didn't want to write another novel at that period in my life. I'd finished a particular vein of fiction. And I went off and edited the Oxford Companion to English Literature for the Oxford University Press, which was working on a big reference book, sort of big catalogue of literature. It was great fun. It used completely different parts of the brain. It was very absorbing. I worked much longer hours on that than I do on fiction, because I was able to. I started at sort of 9 in the morning and went on till 6 or 7 at night, because I was engrossed and I was getting somewhere. Whereas with fiction, you're drained after 3 or 4 hours. You need to stop, even when it's going well.
Do you live in London?
I live mostly in London, yes.
What's London like? Does London have a literary community as such, where people get together, or a London bar or pub where writers gather and this sort of thing?
Well, I always say no to this question, but in fact there probably is a literary community in that I know most of the writers. Most of the writers that are around I've met at parties. There's the usual sort of publisher's party circuit where a lot of writers arrive promptly at 6 o'clock and start drinking and enjoy themselves. I tend not to do that. I'm more of a home person. But there are... there's a club called the Groucho Club, which is for writers and publishers, and people hang out there a bit. There's a sort of circuit. There are some pubs that people go to, some restaurants where they're more likely to go to than others. But it's rather informal. It's not organised. You know, I suppose I go to several events, and a lot of my best friends are writers.
Well, you'll have to stop in at Elaine's while you're here in New York. You've heard of Elaine's, haven't you?
Tell me about Elaine's.
Big literary hangout. George Plimpton and Woody Allen, and they all hang out. I've always been too intimidated to go because Elaine, who runs it, doesn't like people who are outsiders. So I'm waiting for Woody Allen to invite me. And
then you'll feel you've got a proper invitation.
That's true. But unfortunately, I've never met Woody Allen, and I doubt that he's ever going to invite me. So, Woody, if you're out there...
Oh, now this is his big chance to ask.
Take you too. We'd have a big table there, and Elaine, with Woody sitting there, won't insult us.
That'd be very nice.
Well, it was wonderful having the chance to meet you. This is a wonderfully written book, and it's given me additional insights about Britain, and... we were talking about it because I was comparing our two cultures. There are differences, but I think in the long run we're an awful lot alike. And you're doing a wonderful job. I don't want you to stop writing. Just because you've done it before, keep it up. Your new book is going to be set in, you say Korea? Did you say Korea?
Cambodia, they call it now. Yeah, some of it's set there, yes.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Margaret Rabble, thank you very much.
Thank you.